So Genesis 22, what has just happened is finally, after over a decade of waiting, Abraham and Sarah were finally given their child of promise, Isaac. And Genesis 22 is really famous. I think pretty much everyone here has heard the story. It's where God calls Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. You guys have all heard the story, right? So we're not going to really go over the story too much. We're going to more go over the whys of it. So like I said, I'm going to be asking you guys questions just to see like kind of what you're thinking about these things. Now, the grand overarching why that you guys probably already know, and I'm just going to say it off the bat, the grand overarching reason of why is to reflect the eventual sacrifice of Jesus. Right? You guys know that, right? So Abraham is reflective of God the Father. Isaac is reflective of God the Son. And he's bringing him up onto Mount Moriah to sacrifice him. There's a lot of parallels, right? Isaac was the child of promise. Jesus is the child of promise. Through Isaac, all of humanity is blessed. Through Jesus, all of humanity is blessed. Isaac and Abraham, he has to go on top of a mountain to be sacrificed. Isaac carries his own wood up the mountain to be sacrificed. Jesus had to carry his own cross up the mountain to be sacrificed. And actually, there's a lot of evidence from Mount Moriah that there's a pretty good possibility that the very place that Isaac was supposed to be sacrificed is the very place that Jesus was crucified. Geographically, it's the same area. It's the same exact mountain that Jesus was crucified on, which is really cool. There's a lot of awesome parallels there. But we're more going to be focusing on the whys for Abraham and his life. So every now and then I'll touch on the gospel portion of it. But for the most part, I just want you guys to really be thinking of why personally for Abraham and for Isaac was this event a good thing? Because it was. And we'll talk about it a lot more. But let's go to Genesis 22, verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, he said, here I am. He said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Two words in here that I want to point out to you guys that help us understand a little bit more of the whys. The first word is tested. Notice it said God tested Abraham. The word tested in Hebrew and in Greek is the exact same word for tempted. You guys know that? Same word. So it really all depends on the subject as to whether it's going to be translated tempted or tested. So if the subject is Satan, it's always translated tempted, right? But if the subject is God, it's always translated tested. And the reason why I believe that God chose to do that is because he wants to show us that every event in our lives that happens is either a temptation or it's a testing, depending on the person doing it. Does that make sense? Now, at all points in this time, whenever it's tempted or tested, technically, you can say that, do you think Abraham was being tempted during this time as well? Yeah, right? I'm sure Satan was like, dude, don't do it. You know, and the temptations from Satan were probably pretty real, right? You know, dude, God promised you the son, right? He's been cheating you for 13 years. He finally gave you a boy. Now he's going to ask you to kill it? How's that fair, right? And there could have been some really intense temptation happening on Abraham's heart. And we know that temptation was definitely present. The reason why I don't think like it really focuses on Abraham, the only person who seems to be questioning this happening is Isaac, if you guys notice. Isaac later on is going to be like, dude, what are you doing, Dad? You know, like he's carrying the wood up. His dad's got a knife. He's got fire. And he's like, Dad, like we don't have an animal. And his dad's like, don't worry about it. And he's like, it's kind of weird. And then he starts tying him up. He's like, this is really weird. And then he's like, so Isaac is the only one who questions it because this directly reflects the crucifixion of Jesus. The father is resolved the entire time that this is going to happen, but the son is the one who questions, right? Father, if it be your will, let this cup pass. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will. You guys get that? So that's the whole reason why it's happening this way, why it's only saying it that way. But it definitely shows us in our life that no matter what event comes in our lives, negative or positive, there's always those two perspectives, right? There's the perspective of Satan, where he sees the event as an opportunity to tempt you, which means that the word tempt means to lead you away, right? To get you off the path that God has for you. But the word test is a little different, right? If I'm testing something, if I'm creating a product, and I test it, what am I expecting to happen? What do I want to happen, should I say? I want it to pass, right? Nobody designs a product and tests it hoping that it fails. Okay? However, when you're tempting someone, you're hoping that they're going to fail. You're hoping that they're going to give in. But testing is always, the reason why it's always used that way for God, because his perspective is he wants you to pass. That gives a little bit of a help to us when we understand James 1 is a passage that's like this, where James is showing us the divine perspective of temptation, where he says, let it be considered all joy when you encounter any trial, right? For the testing of yourself produces what? Patience. And let patience have its perfect work in you, that you may be complete, lacking in nothing. And then later on in James 1:19, he says, and count it all joy, blessed is the man who is tempted. For when he is tempted, after he is tempted, once he is approved, he will receive the crown of life, as to all those who love the glorious appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ. So James is trying to show the glory of whatever negative event happens inside of our life. And we'll see exactly what the positive to this situation was, what God was trying to do in Abraham's life, that there is something beautiful that God is trying to bring about, which is a different perspective that we as Christians are supposed to have. We as Christians, we acknowledge when situations are bad. So God at no point says, hey, sacrifice your son, but it's really a good thing. It's a good thing that you're going to kill your son. He never says that that's a good thing. He's saying the testing is that this is going to produce something good. You guys get that? So no matter what trial happens in my life, it's not like God's going to look at me and say, hey, Peter, it's a good thing that you have depression. That's a good thing. Right? It's not a good thing, but it can produce something good. Or he's not going to look at me and be like, hey, Peter, it's a good thing that you're going to spend the next week and I'm going to feel really distant from you and you're going to be tempted like crazy. Right? He's not going to say that's a good thing, but it can produce something good. Everything we go through can produce something beneficial or beautiful. 2 Corinthians 4:16, right? He says this light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more an exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Right? So no matter what trial we go through in our lives, no matter what suffering or temptation or whatever, there's some sort of an eternal glory that God is trying to produce in us that we can't see. And we'll talk specifically about what Abraham's was in a second. The second word that's important is the word love. Just so you guys know, this is the first time that the Bible has ever used the word love. Isn't that interesting? It's been 22 chapters and the word love hasn't been used yet. And that's weird because God is love, right? And it's like it's never been used. And you'd think that it would be used in Genesis 1, where God introduces Adam to Eve, right? I mean, that was love, wasn't it? It was a beautiful love. Or maybe even when God created Adam and the love that God felt for Adam. And that would be amazing. But there's something to be said about God waiting to this point to use love. What he's demonstrating is that the greatest view of love, notice this, the greatest view of love is the sacrifice of the Father of his Son. That's the greatest view of love. The biblical New Testament authors saw this correlation. Let me give you an example. 1 John 3, verse 16 says this, by this we know love, that Christ laid down his life for us, and therefore we must also lay down our lives for our brethren. Right? So the idea there is that the greatest, if you ever want to understand love, you really want to understand what love is, understand the love that the Father had for his Son in the sacrifice of him. Right? When I was younger than I am now, I used to always focus on the sacrifice of Jesus for us because it was so beautiful to me. And it still is to this day. It's incredibly beautiful that Jesus gave up his life freely for all of us. That's amazing. But as I grew up and as I understood my parents a little bit better, I started to understand the deep amount of sacrifice that it cost the Father to sacrifice us. I think what it really hit me, the moment that really hit me, was my dad. And you guys have met my dad. He's a really stoic dude. He's like, he doesn't really show emotion very much, but he's just like, he's this tough, like awesome guy. And even growing up, he was always like that. He's very tough, very somber, very stoic. And he's a very tough guy. And I never really saw him really emote very much. And it was interesting to me the first time I deployed to Afghanistan, where they knew where I was deploying. I was deploying to Afghanistan. They knew I was deploying to a war zone. They knew that I could have potentially died. And it was interesting. I mean, my mom was just like bawling as I was like going to the airport. She was just crying and weeping. But it was the first time I actually saw my dad like really look like genuinely concerned. Like he didn't He kind of looked like he was tearing up a little bit, but he genuinely, I could tell, like my dad, I know my dad, and he was very, like I could tell he was very nervous, and he was very fearful over what was happening. And I'd never seen him like that before. And my dad is like this weird dude who, like, he's not afraid of death. Like, my dad does, like, weird things all the time where, like, he could get killed, and he's just like, I don't care, you know? Like, he just goes and he does it. And I knew for a fact in that moment that, like, for my dad, the greatest tragedy would be knowing that his son is going to die. That was for him the greatest tragedy that could happen in his life. It wasn't him being in danger and him dying. It was the idea that his son could die. And I could tell that he was very fearful. Do you guys get that? And it really, like, sunk in for me of, like, how much the father must have loved me, right? That he, like, would allow his son to die on my behalf. You know, whenever I go to the Salvation Army, I always ask him that question. I ask him, you know, like, how many of you guys have kids? And, like, everyone in there has kids. And a lot of the guys who are in the Salvation Army, the reason why they're there is for their kids. They're like, man, I don't want to be like this for my son. You know, I don't want to be a drunk. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't want to be a drug addict for my child. I want to be a good father, and I can't do that right now. And I always ask them, like, how many of you guys would give anything for your children? They all raise their hand, and I believe them, because here they are giving up their alcohol, their drugs, the thing that they've been using their whole lives for the sake of their children. And I say, how many of you would sacrifice your children for something? And all their hands go down. They're like, no, nothing on this earth is worth sacrificing my son. And the idea of the Bible is that you are worth the sacrifice of the son, right? This is the love. This is the divine love that we need to understand. And it also helps us understand our love for others. What does it mean that we really love someone else? What does it mean? It means that we should be willing to sacrifice for them. Right? I hate it in our culture that the word love is so watered down that I could just use it, right? I love ice cream, and I love you too. You know, like, it's the same word, you know. I love my wife, I love my friend, I love my dog, you know, it's all the same word. And there's really no level to love anywhere in there. And because of that, the word love just kind of gets watered down and kind of becomes nothing. And I've heard a lot of men say, like, dude, I would die. You know, that's like the top, right? I would die for my wife. And usually what I tell them is, like, look, dying for something is a split-second decision. It's really not a big deal. You know, I was willing to die. It's really not hard to be willing to give your life for someone or something. First of all, it's so vague. That's like, you know, I'm willing to die. Do you know what it's like to die? Do you know what you're giving up? Do you know? Like, does that even equate to you? Are you in a situation right now where you're having to give your life? No, right? So you don't even know if you'd be willing to do it if the situation ever arose, first off. Secondly, you don't really know what you're giving. It's really a meaningless kind of phrase when you say I'd be willing to die for someone. That's why it's like the true amount of sacrifice that we demonstrate to people is not in the fact that I say I would be willing to die for you. That's important. But here's the deal. If you're really willing to die for someone, you're also willing to live for them. Meaning you're willing to sacrifice things here and now for that person. Right? If that was the only way I could tell someone I love them, then you would never know if I loved you. Right? Because how do you know if I'm sincere? I would die for you. Okay. I'll keep that in mind in case someone ever comes to this church with a shotgun. You know, that I could hide behind you. You know, you give me that go-ahead to do that. You know, but it doesn't really mean anything in the day-to-day trenches. Does that make sense? How do we demonstrate love? Like, how do I really demonstrate love to people? If I say, right, what 1 John 3 is really getting at, by this we know love, that it's not just that the Father was willing to make a split-second decision. Right, giving your life is a split-second decision. Crucifying your son is not a split-second decision. Does that make sense? There's a lot of thought that goes into that of, like, I'm giving up my son. Now, I'm giving up my kid. This is someone that I've had a relationship with for all of eternity, and I'm sacrificing. I'm literally giving this up for everybody else. That's insane. So when you think about your life, don't just think I would die for someone. Think about, would you be willing to give that which means the most to you for this person? Would you be willing to give anything to help this person, no matter what it is? And let's just think about simple. I mean, if you can't even love on the macro, like, dude, let's just focus on the micro. Usually what I tell people when I'm counseling, I'm like, okay, that's great, you die for them. Would you be willing to just, like, text her every day and tell her that you love her? You know, would you be willing to do that? Would you be willing to go on a date with her once a week? Would you be willing to, instead of watching a football game, just hang out with your wife? Would you be willing to do that? Like, well, I don't understand. You can't do that. You can't die for somebody. You can't give up a football game for your wife. How much do you think you can give up your life for her? That's like so ridiculous, isn't it? That we say those words. Or how about this? You know, I die for my kids. I give my life for my kids. Would you just go to their talent show? You know? As opposed to going to your meeting. Right? Would you just support them in anything that they do? Would you just support one of their dreams? Just be like, hey, son or daughter, I love you so much. I'm just going to support one of your dreams. Would you sacrifice a little bit of time just to talk to them? Tell them that you're proud of them. You see what I'm saying? That those big words, they don't mean anything. And we ask those questions about yourself. When you say that you love someone, what do you mean? Are you willing to sacrifice anything for that person? Are you willing to give up anything for that person? Right? And I'm confronted with this all the time, where just how selfish I am. Where like I say I love these people, and then they ask me to do something, I'm like, ugh. It's like, it's going to take like 4 hours out of my life, man. Like, and I just like, they have like, what am I going to get out of it? Nothing, you know? And it shows what? That, do I love them? Yeah, I love them, but how great is my love? Right? Not so great, right? Not so great. Maybe I need to learn a little bit from Genesis 22 and learn a little bit about what's going on in my life. So when God is asking, so here's the difference. When God sacrificed Jesus, who is it for? It's for us, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life, right? It was for us. Okay? When Abraham is sacrificing his son Isaac, who's it for? It's for God. It's for God. Do you guys get that? So we all say we love God, right? We love God. And Jesus goes one step further. He says, if you don't love me more than mother, father, brother, sister, husband, wife, children, you have no part of me. So he's saying, you must love me supremely if you want to be with me, more than anything. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that's important in a sec. But he says, you got to love me supremely. Here's the thing. If you're not willing to sacrifice something for God, what does that show about your love? Not very good, right? Let me put it this way. How many of you guys would be confident to tonight go before God and say, God, whatever you want for my life, I am giving you freedom to speak into my life right now. Whatever you say, I will do. Right? We're all like, oh my gosh. What's that? I think that's like for the super saints, right? You know, I go to church and I read my Bible. I sacrifice to be here, right? You know, like, I mean, isn't that enough? Well, do you love God supremely? Now, if you don't, which, spoiler alert for you guys, I don't, okay, I would be terrified to pray that tonight. Because I got some things in my head that I'm like, nope, you know, like, don't touch that, you know, like, I mean, do I really mean it? Because in my heart, it's like, man, I really love my job. I would hate it if God told me to give up my job. I really love my wife. I would hate it if God took away my wife if she died. That would be horrible. I don't know if I would recover, right? There's things in my life that I'm like, I don't really know if I love God that supremely. Well, if that's true, then don't be fake with God. Don't be like, no, I'd surrender all, God. You know, all to you, man. It's all, be honest with him. Be like, God, you know, I got some stuff in my life that I would not be willing to give to you. Can you get me to the place of Genesis 22? Can you get me to the place where Abraham's looking at his son and he's saying, for you, God, I would. I would. I would give up my son for you. And he doesn't just say it, he does it. Right? That's how supremely he trusts God. All right, let's keep moving, though. So he's like, dude, you love your son, give him up. Another important thing, he says it's your only son, only begotten. Right, which once again refers to Jesus. Now, did Abraham have other children? Right, he had Ishmael. So it's not really his only begotten son. But what God is saying is this is the son of promise. This is your only begotten son because he actually, in the last chapter, he gave up Ishmael. He sent him away. It's no longer his son. He doesn't have any rights to Ishmael anymore. So he gave him up. That's something to focus on. But in their culture, the only begotten son, if you had an only begotten son, you could have other children. I could have like daughters. But if I only had one son, that's my only begotten son. That's important. In their culture, having a firstborn son or an only begotten son, it wasn't really about the son. It was about what that son represented. In that culture, an only begotten son represented the future and hope of that family. It represented everything. Because in their culture, in our culture, we just think about, you know, my life. I'm just thinking about my life. We're not really thinking about our legacy, what's coming after us. We don't really think about life after death, do we? Not too much, not too many of us. Their culture, that was what their whole culture was about. It was about hierarchy. Am I setting things up for the next generation? What's my son going to be like? What's going to happen with my family? That's the way they were thinking. So for them, once again, it was more important for them to have a son than it was for them to even have a life. In fact, all their life was just about how is my son going to prosper with this. That's what they were thinking. So to sacrifice your son, you're not just sacrificing a life. You guys get that? You're sacrificing your future and your hope, your prosperity. Your family is dying with that son. That was the picture here. He's not just giving up a life. He's giving up everything. And that helps us understand, why is Jesus always called the only begotten son? You guys ever wonder that? He wasn't begotten, right? It's not like God hooked up with some female god and had like a son. He's like, my boy, you know? Obviously, we as Christians, we say that Jesus was eternally begotten. What does that mean? He was never born, but he's begotten of God, right? To show what kind of a person he is. He's also called the firstborn, right? In Colossians 1, verse 16, he's called the firstborn. And in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 4, he's called the firstborn of God as well. And the question is, why is Jesus always called the only begotten, and why is he called the firstborn? Do you see why? Because that culture, they would grab what's being said here. It's not just that Jesus relates to God, the Father. That he's just like, you know, he could have been, it could have, they could have said the relationship between the Father and Son was different. They could have been the friends, right? The buddies, right? I'm the buddy of God. You know, Jesus, the best friend of God. It could have been that, you know, the BFF of God, you know, and that's who he sacrificed. The BFF. No, but the only begotten signifies that when the Father looked at the Son, what did he see? Future, prosperity, hope, everything was rooted in the Son. Everything that he cared about was rooted in the Son, and he's killing that for us. Right? That's just, it's upping the level of how we understand the Father. Now, I'm going to skip the next part. I already explained it to you guys. So he gets up. It's impressive that he does it the first day, right? He doesn't put this off, which is really out of character for Abraham. If you've been with us in the story of Abraham, this dude is the king of procrastination, right? God tells him, right, Abraham, get up, get out of your father's house, go to the land that I call you. It took him like 50 years to get to the land that God had for him. Longest move in history, right? It took him seriously like multiple decades to get there, right? And a couple times he left. So every single time God has asked him to do something, it's taken Abraham a little bit of time, and he's failed a couple times before he's done it. But this time, he just does it. He just does it. And this is one of the things I love most about the story of Abraham. See, most stories in the Bible, you read like Jeremiah, you read Daniel, you read the book of Acts, and you just assume that these people, they got saved, and they're just perfect. You know, it reminds me when I was a little kid, when I was like 5. I was growing up, and I would look at adults, and I assumed, because I was an idiot, right? I was a little kid. I assumed that some people were born tall and adults, and some people were born little kids. Because I could never, as a kid, do you see what was going on in my head? I was like, how do I become that? Like, I was like, I could never become that. Like, I'm so little. Like, I could never really get it. And I'm like, you know what? I woke up the next day, and I'm the same height. And I woke up the day after that, I was the same height. You know, so the growth happened so... So the growth is so small and so spread out that I was like, I'll never become that. And like, that is a joke as a 5-year-old, but even as a grown up Christian, I still think the same ways about people in the Bible. Does that make sense? Where I'm like, I think some people are just like really saved, you know? And then I'm like kind of saved, you know? Or I'm like, you know, I'm like this little kid Christian, and I'll just be a little kid Christian forever. But those people, you know, the Abraham, Moses, I'll never relate to them. How old was Moses when he finally got it together? 80. How old was Abraham when he finally got it together? How old is he in the story? He's over 100 years old. So it's like, dude, did he get to the place where he was faithful before God? Yeah. It took him a century, though. So it's like, when I look at that, I'm like, well, I'm only 27. If I live to 100, I'll probably get like that, too. You know, like, if the Lord tarries and he gives me 100 years, I have the potential to be like that. When I read the stories of Abraham before Genesis 22, that dude sucks, right? He fails on every single part of the promises of God. And the beautiful thing about it is if you read all of Genesis, you realize, like, dude, Abraham didn't start out in Genesis 22. He slowly developed till the time of Genesis 22. Now, here's the question. how did God get him from meek, cowardly Abraham in Genesis 12 to brave Abraham in Genesis 22? What did he do in that 50-year period to get Abraham from this weak, cowardly guy who wasn't even willing to move for God to a guy who's willing to sacrifice his only son for God? What happened between those chapters? That's it. A lot of series of tests and trials. So if we look at Genesis 22 and we're like, dude, I'm not there. You know how God gets you from where you're at to here? Tests, trials, circumstances, right? That's the only way. That's the only way to build faith, is years and years and years of tests and trials and circumstances that you do not know how to deal with, so that you have to rely on God, and struggling with sin and struggling with temptation and struggling with relationships and making mistakes. That's the only way. That's the only way to get from where I'm at to where Abraham's at. Only possible way. Doesn't happen overnight, right? But even when I was going to church, I was like, that doesn't sound right. Because I'd look at the pastor and be like, dude, I've been listening to Scott since I was 5 years old. Dude hasn't changed. You know, like, I mean, he's like, he's lost a little hair up here, but he's like the same guy, you know? He's like, he's giving the same sermons. I'm like, no, dude, Scott, for sure, man. He's been perfect since he gave his life to the Lord. For sure, dude, for sure. But now that I'm like getting to know Scott better on staff, I'm going to give you guys a little insight into Scott that I guarantee he wouldn't mind me saying this, because he tries to show this to people as best as he can. That dude needs a lot of work, just like all of us. He ain't perfect. He doesn't even profess to be perfect. He's a wreck. He struggles in a lot of different areas. Now, he's a lot further along the road than I am, but he ain't perfect. See, every Christian's on the same path. We're just at different spots in the path. Does that make sense? No one's better than anyone else. We're just at different areas of the path. Now, so that's how you do it. That through trials, through circumstances, God grows you over time, right? If you've ever seen the movie Doctor Strange, which is a great movie, by the way, comes out on DVD and Blu-ray next week. But anyway, in Doctor Strange, right, he sits down with the Ancient One, and he's like, he doesn't know anything about magic, and he sits down before her, and he says, how do I get from here to there? And she says, well, how did you become a doctor? He says, study and practice years of it. She goes, that's right. See, we as Christians, we'd like to believe there's a seminar or a book. I'd be like, dude, I read this book the other day. You read this book, you'll be like me, man. And like, you're like, dude, that's crazy. And you read it, and you're still I don't even remember what I read. You know, and you're like, still you. Like, it's weird. You go to this seminar, you go to this camp, you're like, dude, God was there, man. He spoke to me. I grew so much. Then you go back down the mountain. You're the same dude. You're like, what happened? Well, because you can't grow in a week. It doesn't work that way. It's years. It's years and years and years of God allowing this information to seep into your heart and to move you. And the reason why so many Christians are so discouraged is not because God's not growing them. It's because he's not growing them enough. That they feel discouraged because they're not growing as much as they want to be growing. Zechariah 4 verse 10 says, woe to the one who despises the day of small things. Now, beyond God putting us through trials and circumstances, I'll put it this way too, it makes all the difference in the world of how you view those trials and circumstances. Okay, because there's another guy in this book that we've been reading about, that we just saw his end, Lot, Genesis 19. Right, we just talked about him last week, Lot. Did he go through a lot of trials and circumstances? Yeah. Did it grow him? No, right? At the end of his life, hanging out in a cave, having sex with his own daughters, right? All of his kids become the worst enemies Israel's ever seen, right? He failed, okay? Now, we talked about last week that he was saved, but he definitely failed in every way that he could have. And so we see two people. We see Abraham somehow has become this great man as a result of trials, and Lot became an even bigger scumbag as a result of the trials that he went through. So what's the difference between Abraham and Lot? How did Abraham grow? Because both of them were the same, right? When you first pick up the story of Abraham and Lot, they're at the same level. They both kind of suck, right? But now Abraham's up here and Lot's down here. What's the difference between the two of them? That's a really good way to put it. That's a really good way to put it. And just to put it a little more simply than that, it's just, what do you desire? Put it as simple as you can, in Genesis 15, when God made the covenant with Abraham, this is what he said to him. He says, Abraham, be not afraid. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward. At the end of the day, Abraham just wanted God. Now, he got his eyes off of God all the time, which is what all of us do. But at the end of the day, at the center of his heart, he was always saying, I want more of God. I want more of God. That's what I want. Lot, not so much. He wanted God, but he wanted God more like a lot of Christians today want God. I want the benefits of God. You know, I want what God could get me. All right, so God definitely wasn't first. He's there, but he's like a close second, you know? And it all depends on your view. What do you desire? If you really want God supremely, if you say in your heart, man, I want you supremely. I know I'm not there yet, God. I know that things are before you, God. I know that I sin. I know I idolize things and people. I know that happens. But I want you to be first in my life. That's what I want. That's my deepest desire, is I just want you to be first in my life. Then no matter what trials or circumstances come into your life, you'll realize, you'll see them as what? Opportunities to grow your love for God. Does that make sense? Now, if you say, I love God, but I also love the things in my life, and, you know, God, I want to love you more, but you never say, I want to love you most, all the trials in your life, all they're going to do is they're going to point out to you why you can't trust God. They're like, well, I love you, God, and yet you let me lose this, right? That's what Lot's thinking. But God, I love you, and you're going to take away my city and my wife and my kids, and he's getting all bent out of shape, and he's hiding in a cave. He's like, whatever, screw it, and that's how he lives his life. Right? And you could see really quickly what Lot treasured. At no point did he say, you know what, God, this hurts, but I still want you more. He never said that. Abraham says that. Lot doesn't say that. And that's why Genesis 22 verse 5 is so important. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder. He says yonder. He says that. But anyway, I will go yonder and worship. You just underline that word in your Bible, and we will come back to you. The word worship, I know, what do we usually think about in the church when we say worship? What do we think? Music. All right. You read this word in the Hebrew, not a single one of the definitions has anything to do with music. You know what this word means, literally? It means to get on your knees and your face before someone. That's what it means. It means literally to get on your knees and your face before somebody, to bow down to them. So when we're saying worship, hey, you know what? Singing praise songs to God is a type of worship. But if it's not coming out of a heart that is bowed down to God, it is nothing. You may like it because of the melody, and you may like some of the words. But if it's not coming from a life that's like, God, I am on my knees and my face before you, are my everything. And if you are not my everything, I want you to be my everything, God. That's what you're saying. I am man, you are God. I want to give everything I am to you, be glorified in my life. That's what we're trying to say. And in fact, a lot of the worship music that we sing says stuff like that, right? Right? For you, God. Right? My favorite worship song ever, if you guys want to know this, Be Thou My Vision. My absolute favorite worship song that's ever been written, because the lyrics in that song are just incredibly powerful. Even if you don't like music, just read the words to that song, because that's what that whole song is about. God, be my vision, Lord of my heart. What is he saying? Be my everything. Be the thing I think about. Be my imagination, my fantasy, my goal, my glory, my hope. Be everything, and you're not. Be thou my wisdom, and thou my true word. Right? That's what he's saying. Do you guys see what he's getting at in that song? That's a song that's about someone who is wanting, desiring to be bowed down to God, that wants to worship God, but isn't. You can go your whole life listening to Caleb on a nonstop loop and never worship God. And you could be a person who would, you probably go crazy after about the first hour, but yeah, it's the same three songs over and over again. Caleb! This is hell! All right. Or you could go your entire life never singing one worship song and worship God supremely with your life. It's all about what you do with your life. What are you willing to sacrifice? Are you willing to bow down to God? Abraham wanted to submit to God. He wanted to bow down. When God corrected him, he listened. And that's why I love that Caleb brought up Saul versus David. when Saul got confronted with sin, you know what he did? Justified, made excuses, didn't listen. When David got convicted of sin, that dude hit his knees, right? He's like, dude, I suck. And he just went before God and said, God, I don't want to justify. I don't want to be righteous in my own eyes. I want you. I want you. And my sin, the crap in my heart, is keeping me from you. No matter what you got to do, God, get rid of this issue in my life. I want you. And it's always easy for me when I'm counseling someone, right? Like I said, actions just speak way louder than words. When I'm counseling people and they're like, man, I want to get right with God. I want to do this. I'm like, that's great, man. You know, you should start coming to accountability groups every week. And they're like, well, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's kind of late and it's out of my way. It's like, well, how seriously do you want it? You know, man, you should, you know, where are you viewing porn? Oh, I view it on my phone like every day. Like, would you put accountability software on there? Yeah, it's like $50 a month. It's like $50 a year. You know, like, you know, do you have cable? Oh, I was just wondering, you know, like that $50 a year is too much. Do you have cable? Well, yeah, of course I got the premium package. But, you know, that $50 a year, dude, that's just too much on me, man. I can't do it, dude. I can't make that. Okay, would you be willing to go in for counseling? Well, you know, I'd love to, but, you know, it's too much on my life right now, bro. I'm like, okay, well, you can tell me all you want that you take this seriously, but you are not showing it one bit. You're not willing to sacrifice anything for God. Or people with their marriage are like, dude, I want my marriage to work. You willing to come in for counseling? Well, you know what I mean? But I want it to work. Well, what do you want? You know, I know that God could do all things. You know what someone's saying when they say that?
I don't have to do anything.
God could just supernaturally come in and fix me and fix my marriage. You know, that's what I want to happen. God ain't going to do that, because if God did that, he'd be justifying your laziness and your inability to love. Right? That's not what God's going to do. He's not an enabler. He's not a giant enabler in the sky. That's not what he does. Abraham's finally got to the place where he can do this. So let's talk about this Isaac thing real quick. Of why this is so good. Why this is so good for both father and son to do this. Okay? Now this gives a gift to Abraham and something really important. Throughout Abraham's life, having a son has been his supreme desire. Do you guys get that? If you ever asked Abraham, what is your idol? What's your idol? He'd be like, having a son. Immediately. That would just come to his head. Having a son, that's my idol. That is the thing that I have always valued over God. That's the thing I've always valued over God. I've wanted a son. He wanted a son so badly, he was willing to sin to get one. It's like, God's not giving me a son. I'm going to have sex with my maid. That's how I'm going to get a son. That's how badly he wanted a son. And inside of our lives, we have things that we value over God. If you don't think you have something you value over God, you're not thinking hard enough. There's something in your life that rivals God. And every single one of the tests that you're going to get into, the temptations you're going to get into, is going to pull that to the front of your face. Like, this is what you love more than God. This is what you love more than God. It's going to keep coming up, keep coming up, keep coming up. For a lot of men that I counsel, is being married. The idea of being married is the thing that they value more than God. Dude, I would give anything to be married, right? This is everything to me. It's my relationship. I need to have a good one. For me, that was and still is a huge idol in my life. Marriage has always been, having a good relationship with someone has always been that idolatry of my life. So much so that I was even willing to fantasize and go against God in pornography to try to find some value and meaning and validation in some sort of relationship that I could have, even if it was just fantasy. You guys get that? Always been an idol of my life. Okay, and then I started to date, and I idolized that, and I treated it very shrewdly, and I was a fool, and I ruined relationships. And then finally I got into a relationship with Emma. And it was, you'd think that, like, man, I've learned my lesson. I'm ready to give it to God. And you know what I found? I was incredibly controlling. Incredibly controlling in my relationship, trying to keep everything just as it was and trying to be overprotective. Why? Because had marriage ceased to be an idol of my life? No, still an idol. And every single time, even to this day, when I see intense fear creep up in my heart, which happens all the time, by the way. Happens all the time. Intense fear creeps up in my heart. It all comes from my deep idolization of marriage, where I want this to work. I want this to work, and I'm going to make it work, even to the extent where I'd be willing to sometimes walk away from God to have things my way. And guess what happens? Whenever anything threatens my marriage, you know who I immediately blame? God. God, what the heck, man? You said I should have this marriage, and you're not letting it go the way I want it to go, right? And I get pissed at God. You know what it shows? Where's God? Where's God? Below my marriage. Right? Why am I getting upset at God? God says, dude, I'm all you need. And little things happen with my marriage, and I'm like, no, it's not fair. God's like, I thought I was all you needed. I surrender all, right? Isn't that the song you sang on Wednesday? It was like, yeah, but you know, not my marriage. You know, like that's not. I'm not going to put that on the altar, right? You see, is Abraham putting Isaac on the altar in chapter 22? Yeah, but guess what? His entire stinking life, God has been putting his son on the altar over and over and over. You guys see that? I mean, why didn't he just tell Abraham to begin with, you're going to have a son when you're 95? Right? He could have easily said that. But what does he say? You're going to have a son 20 years later. Where's my son? He's coming. Right? He's on back order. Just give us a little bit of time, man. You know, it's coming. Don't worry about it. Right? And he keeps saying that. And we're like, why would God do that to him? Why wouldn't he just tell him? Because if he told him, it wouldn't be revealing Abraham's what? Idolatry. See, a lot of times we think that things in our life make us sinners. We're like, you know, like something happens in our life where we lose something, or something tragic happens, or maybe we're going through a lot of trials or temptation, whatever it is, and sin starts coming out of our hearts, and we're like, that situation made me sinful, you know? Well, no, you were always a sinner. That situation just revealed what you are. Does that make sense? That was always below the surface. But this situation is now revealing your idolatry, your willingness to go away from God, your evil, wicked heart. Does that make sense? God's just bringing it to the surface. That's all he's doing. God, over and over, over decades and decades, kept bringing Isaac to the surface of, this is your idol, this is your idol, this is your idol, this is your idol. Finally, he's giving him a son, and now he's saying, kill him. Why? Why is he doing this again? He's bringing sin to the surface. It's finally getting rid of it. It's getting it out. Man, as he's doing this over and over again, bringing it to the surface, he's revealing the idolatry of Abraham till finally he gets to the place where Abraham can honestly say, God, this is my idol, and you are not to be rivaled, and I am putting it to death before you. It's done. I just want you. That's what he's doing. In our lives, we think God is cruel, right? We're like, dude, why does God give us stuff? Just take it away. You know why he does it? Because if he just gave you stuff, you would worship the thing instead of the creator. The creation as opposed to the creator, which is what our tendency is to do all the time. And to worship and serve the creation is always slavery to the one who does it. For two reasons. Number one, nothing on this earth can satisfy your heart the way that God can. If Isaac became Abraham's idol, that would be the most controlling, abusive father-son relationship ever. So many parents, when they have kids, their kids are their salvation. And how do they act towards their kids? They try to live vicariously through them. They try to control them. They try to cripple them so that the kids have to stay in the house their entire lives. They get frustrated with them all the time. They become very manipulative towards them. And like, where is this coming from? It's coming from idolatry. That's where it's coming from. It's coming from their inability to let go, their inability to trust God. All their fear, all their doubts, all their manipulations is all just revealing their junk. You guys understand that? If God wouldn't have done this to Abraham, Abraham would have continued to idolize his son, and it would have ruined their relationship. If God doesn't call me to put my marriage on the altar every day, I am going to idolize my wife, and I'm going to ruin our relationship. That's what I'm going to do. It's not a maybe. It's not a, it could happen. No, it will happen. I will ruin our relationship if God doesn't do this to me. Right? So is it really cruel that God's doing this to Abraham? Is he a jerk? Right? I've heard a lot of atheists be like, man, what a jerk. Told him to sacrifice Isaac. What a jerk. You know, like, what a, I mean, he knew what was going to happen, and he's just testing him. You know, and that's what a lot of people think that's going on when they see that word test. They're like, dude, God's just, he's up in heaven and he's like, man, you don't love me enough. You know, kill your son. Then I'll know you love me. Right? Like, he's like a jealous lover. You know, he's like this jealous loser in the sky. Yeah, that's not what's going on. He's doing this for the sake of Abraham. Remember what he said? Take your son, your only son, whom you love. You want to continue to love your son, Abraham? You can't love unless you're first complete. Incomplete people, people who are not filled and satisfied in Christ alone, will always idolize the people that they supposedly love. And they will always manipulate, and they will always control, and they will always destroy every relationship that they are a part of because of fear. In the Proverbs it says this, the fear of the wicked will come upon them, but the desire of the righteous will be granted. Here's what it's saying. Fear reveals idolatry. Why are you so afraid? Why are you so terrified of this thing happening? Because that thing means more to you than anything else. Why does the fear come upon you? Because if I'm so terrified, I mean, think about our relationship with Emma. If I'm like, dude, I'm afraid she's going to leave me. I'm afraid she's going to leave me. I'm afraid our relationship's going to fail. I'm afraid I'm going to fail as her husband. My fear is going to make me into a bad husband, and then eventually our relationship's going to fall apart. I'll be like, oh, man, it happened. I knew it was going to happen. You know, and it happened. And all you guys would look at me and be like, well, if you weren't such an idiot, you know, if you weren't such a goober the entire relationship and treating her like a weirdo and calling her every 5 minutes, like, are you cheating on me? Okay, I was just making sure. Okay. And I hang up the phone and be like, and then I love you. Okay. Like, how about now? Okay, okay, okay. And then hang up the phone. My fear would drive Emma crazy and she would leave me. And you'd all be like, well, you did it. Be like, no, no, this is because the world's against me and God did this. And no, your fear did it because you put someone before God. But he says what? The desire of the righteous will be granted. What did the righteous desire? God. God, of course God is going to give himself to you. And if you're complete in Christ, then you're free to finally love. That's the whole point. And God will do this with everything inside of our lives that rises up before him. He'll do it with my career. He's done it with my career multiple times. Since I was 12 years old, the thing that I dreamed most about was becoming a Marine. I became a Marine, you know what I realized? This sucks. this is a stupid dream. You know, I totally regretted it immediately about my decision. And I was like, man, maybe career is not the thing to live for. Right? Maybe I should live for God. And every single time God's bringing something to the surface, I guarantee you, when I have kids, I'm going to idolize them. I'm going to be tempted to idolize them and put them before God. And God's going to have me put my kids on the altar over and over and over again. Until I remember that it is him I serve and him alone. There is no seminar, there is no group, there is nothing that you guys can do to teach you this lesson. You have to live it. You have to live it. So as we read Genesis 22, and I'll just tell you at the end, something beautiful happens, right? Abraham's about to kill his son, and the angel of the Lord comes, and he presents to him a lamb to be slain. And the picture there is like, here's the picture that man had of God. We must give everything to be with God. And then God flips it in Genesis 22 and says, well, yeah, you got to give everything, but actually I am everything, and I will give everything to be with you. Right, so God provides the sacrifice of himself, and that's the gospel. That's the gospel for us, that God provides sacrifice. It's not about us sacrificing for God. God already did the sacrifice. When we're sacrificing, it's for our betterment. Right? God doesn't need it. Does that make sense? Do you think God's up in heaven and he's all insecure? He's like, I hope they love me more than anything. You know, like, or, I don't know if I have value unless they love me. You know, Peter didn't pray to me tonight. Oh, no. You know, like, that's not how he is. Like, God's complete. He doesn't need anything outside of me. My prayer to him, my sacrificing to him, my tithing to him, my giving up of everything to him is for my betterment, not his. He's complete and glorious in himself. He doesn't need anything from me. He is thinking of me. That's why he's asking me to do these things. And that's why he asked Abraham to do it. God provides a sacrifice. He didn't need Abraham. He didn't need Abraham's son. He provides a sacrifice. It's like, dude, I have everything on this planet. If I wanted a kid, I would have just taken a kid. Right? It's not about that. It's about my relationship with you. Do you value me like this so that you can be free? Right? That's what God's doing inside of our lives. Let's pray. And if you guys have any questions, you got a little bit of time. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word. I pray that we would be people like Abraham that learn to lay down the thing that is most important to us. Not because you're cruel and you want to take away things that we love, Lord, but because you want us to genuinely love them. Lord, and the only way we can do that is if we love you first. So please teach us how to do that. And please give us perseverance and confidence as we go through this life and go through this difficult journey with you. In your name, amen.